The Mystery of Super Substantial Bread. Among its other highly spiritual verses, the Lord's Prayer has one verse about praying for daily bread, for nourishment for sustaining physical existence. One can understand this from the point of view of the world's hunger problem, which we know could be solved with the available resources if we wanted to. But did Jesus have something else in his mind when he gave the verse on bread? We all need something to eat to stay alive. Over the history of humanity, acquiring everyday bread and all that is related to it has taken great effort. Even though today, especially in the Western countries, less and less effort is needed to acquire what is necessary, there is still some validity in the Bible verse, "By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food." Genesis 3:19. Those of us who believe in the power of thought and prayer could think that this progress has been, at least to some extent, due to diligent praying of the Lord's Prayer and its verse on daily bread for 2 millennia. Our prayer has been heard. Skeptics and secular people say this progress is entirely due to economic and industrial development. Of course, this is true, as all things have their material aspect as well. At any rate, it seems that the hard work that has been going on over millennia is gradually getting easier. Certainly, in the industrialized countries, our time is no longer entirely consumed by sustaining mere existence. There should be more opportunities to fulfill higher aspirations. Whether we do this is another question. My aim is to discuss the notion of daily bread, the bread Jesus talks about in the Lord's Prayer, from a different perspective than is customary. Almost 2 millennia have passed since Jesus gave this prayer and meditation formula to his followers. The Latin version is as follows: Panem nostrum quotidianum da nobis hodie, which is, in English, "Give us this day our daily bread." This verse doesn't seem to contain any mystical truths, and few people, I believe, have given it any further thought. However, I was surprised when I first read Pekka Ervast's book on the Sermon on the Mount, in which he presents his own translation, commentary, and interpretation of Jesus' address. The book is written in the format of questions and answers. Ervast offers a completely different interpretation for this verse, as well as a different translation. However, this translated has existed for a long time. It can be found in the Latin Vulgate Bible, Panem nostrum supersubstantialem da nobis hodie. This means, "Give us today our supersubstantial bread," or spiritual bread. The original Greek is epiousion, a rare and obscure word that has been given a number of meanings. Could it be that we are supposed to ask for something else than food in this verse? Not just asking for what keeps us alive, but for what keeps us in contact with the Spirit. I can imagine that Ervast was also surprised when he found this translation in the Vulgate. He justifies this translation by pointing out that later on Jesus tells us not to worry what to eat, drink, or wear. Instead, he urges us to look at the birds of the air and the flowers of the field, which are taken care of by our Heavenly Father. This clearly indicates that we need to worry not about food, but about something else. God already knows what we need. Jesus says, "But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well." Matthew 6:33. Even so, when I think about Ervast's observation from today's perspective, it seems possible to justify the translation "daily bread." Jesus often used parables in his teachings. It is natural to view daily bread as a metaphor for the nourishment of spirit. Yet Urdhvast's interpretation is important. We are free to understand and pray for anything we like. Our needs, as well as our consciousness, are different. A prayer is determined by what we understand now and by what the Sermon on the Mount means for us today. Perhaps we have already evolved far enough to pray for spiritual bread. I'm convinced that the Lord's Prayer is Jesus' most authentic teaching in the Bible. Each verse will have a deeper meaning as one meditates on them. Another saying of Jesus supports the spiritual interpretation of daily bread. Man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. Matthew 4:4. When one thinks about these matters, one soon realizes how little one is able to understand the real meaning of these most central verses. Nonetheless, if we delve strenuously into them and seriously attempt to understand them from the point of view of our own lives, we will gradually see how charged they really are. Their meanings have links to many directions, both in the New and the Old Testaments, as well as to spiritual thought and traditions outside the Bible. As I have noted, Hekka Urdhvast offers this famous idea about meditation, quote, "A human being has been endowed with a spiritual tool, allowing him to rule the worlds. The spiritual tool is thought, and its proper use is meditation or prayer. This is a magnificent claim about the power of thought, that one can rule the worlds with the right thought or prayer. In this context, we also remember Jesus' advice in the Lord's Prayer. The real thought or spiritual attitude is different from mere words, as Jesus says. And when you pray, do not keep on babbling like pagans, for they think they will be heard because of their many words." Matthew 6:7. Prayers we have learned in our childhood will easily turn into mindless litanies that we can't really think about anymore. They have lost the spirit and truth that Jesus talks about. Yet these ideals are the true strength of the prayer. We can see that the same prayer can have different meanings depending on the consciousness of the one who's praying. The power of prayer or meditation depends on the individual's state of mind and depth of surrender in faith. I have also heard that in true prayer, we can only ask for more light and understanding for ourselves. In fact, we shouldn't pray for anything else for ourselves. Even so, I don't want to belittle the power of the Lord's Prayer. We are entitled to, and we should, penetrate beyond the words and reach for the true spirit in the words. There is plenty of evidence that the Lord's Prayer can provide a powerful shield in some instances. Indeed, it is a shielding and saving mantra. What is the spiritual bread for which Jesus urges us to pray? There is a saying, "The one who is unwilling to work shall not eat," 2 Thessalonians 3:10. And there is another Bible verse I have already mentioned, "By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food," Genesis 3:19. These both seem to say that one must struggle for bread, raising an immediate question. Does one have to struggle for spiritual bread as well? Isn't spiritual bread free and automatically available? If so, does it mean that the one who is unwilling to work cannot eat super substantial bread? This is the question one faces upon entering the path of self-education. Answering it requires a serious attitude. Furthermore, this path is taught in the secret wisdom of all religions, as well as in esoteric Christianity. Events, stories, and wisdom from various sources seem to indicate that one has to work to receive spiritual bread. Just waiting passively is not enough. The Lutheran Church has made a grave mistake in teaching that spiritual aspiration is not so important, and that the only thing that matters is faith in Jesus' act of redemption. Yet, God helps those who help themselves. When we embark on the spiritual path, we must have faith that we will be helped. Experience tells us that people who act on the basis of that faith will observe changes in their lives. When we meditate on the verse on daily bread and ask for spiritual nourishment, we are taking steps on the stairs of faith and trust. We are no longer thinking about surviving. Instead, we are making progress and proceeding to a new realm. In that realm, we begin to live in the world, but are not of the world. We aim at living and searching for spirit, our true higher consciousness and potential. It's essential nourishment for our spirit. One day, it will not be mere bread and wine, but a feast that is called enlightenment. We all are going toward it. Jesus deals with bread on a few occasions. In those cases, it is usually more than mere nourishment for the physical body. It is a symbol of higher strength and energy, which is love and light in their most spiritual form. Although bread is a symbol for sustaining physical life, it also stands for nourishment of the spiritual life and higher consciousness, which provides our lives with clear meaning and sense. Many people seem to lack the sense in their lives. At one point, when Jesus is talking to the crowd, the people get hungry. The disciples have 5 loaves and 2 fishes with them. Jesus urges the disciples to give them to the listeners, Mark 6:33-44. In so doing, he follows the law of love and giving. When everyone who has something gives to those who don't have anything, there is something for everyone. Most importantly, the one who gives will have more to give. This is the law of love. Love doesn't run out when it's given away. On the other hand, when the law of selfishness and competition rules, those who are weak always get less or are left with nothing. Sharing bread sets an example on how to solve the hunger problem in the world. Furthermore, the bread given away on the mountain is a symbol of spiritual nourishment. It is empowering energy on which one should not scrimp. If generously given, it triggers the right thought and action in the other person. This example will spread, giving strength and fostering faith in a miracle. Did the people who were present see a miracle? Perhaps not, but the disciples did. Those who had eyes to see saw the miracle. Jesus shows us how to share supersubstantial bread, nourishment for spirit. His method here, as well as elsewhere, is turning selfish thinking upside down into giving with love. It is striving toward overcoming our selfishness, which is the greatest plague in the world. When we begin to overcome our selfishness, the gates of light are opened for us. When the truth seeker believes in this logic and acts accordingly, it starts to work spontaneously. It is the water Jesus told about to the woman at the well. But whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. John 4:14. Jesus passed out bread for the last time in his earthly life at the Last Supper. At that point, he said, "This is my body given for you," Luke 22:19. According to theosophy, Jesus' sacrifice of his physical body refers to a high initiation. From an occult point of view, Jesus Christ attained the sun body, or the Sampo body, as it's called in Finnish mythology, after he sacrificed his physical body on Golgotha. This sun body is immortal. Jesus Christ has no need to reincarnate again. The symbolic meaning of the Eucharist is hard to understand, and it is likely to remain a mystery to us. If I were to put it into words, I would say that bread becomes a symbol for the death and resurrection of the Spirit in the Last Supper. It is the allegorical apex of Jesus' earthly teaching work, which he wants us to remember. He installed the Eucharist as remembrance of him. The ritual reminds us of our journey and its higher spiritual goals, loving service and sacrifice. In the Eucharist, bread is consumed, symbolizing the body of Jesus, which at his resurrection was transformed into a light body. Matter becomes light. The physical body becomes an eternal vehicle for spirit. When Jesus says the words of institution in the Last Supper, the disciples do not understand it. Possibly Jesus himself does not fully understand it yet. Only later on, after his sacrificial death, can these words be comprehended. When we participate in the Eucharist, we allow the memory of this transfiguration of matter to enter our body and consciousness. The bread will change. It will become supersubstantial love and light. The Eucharist symbolizes the mystery of this supersubstantial bread. Professor Michael Werner allegedly hasn't eaten for years. He claims that he lives on light and consumes only coffee, fruit juice, and occasionally a glass of wine. At any rate, the idea of light is central in spiritual thinking. In this spirit, there was a seminar called The Wisdom of Light, led by Henrik Skolimowski in Viti, Finland, in 2003. The seminar was organized by the Forum Humanum Society. At the time, Skolimowski was preparing his book, Let There Be Light, The Mysterious Journey of Cosmic Creativity. During the weekend, we pondered on central ideas of the forthcoming book. Skolimowski's main thesis can be summarized as follows. Everything is light. He considered light to be a central agent of evolution. From this perspective, it can be understood a light is the source of all food. Light is at the core of our daily bread. Let me elaborate on this idea. From our school years, we are all familiar with photosynthesis, utilized by the plant kingdom to replenish itself and constantly produce nutrition. Photosynthesis is a huge step in the visible triumph of light, by which it is transformed into living organisms such as grass, trees, and crops. All higher organisms on the earth receive their nourishment from the plants. In fact, they eat condensed light. In Skolimowski's theory, the next wave of evolution initiated by light is called logosynthesis. It takes place in a human being who consumes this light in the form of plants or in a more modulated form in meat. This is an indirect way to consume light, which is preceded one step further away from the first step in the process. In the human being, light is transformed into thought. Logosynthesis originates from the Greek logos, a word that has many meanings, including reason. Through logosynthesis, light has produced human consciousness, through which the universe reflects upon itself. If we think about the relationship of the eye to the human mind, we can say that light has created a being in which the universe can be reflected, seen, and even understood. The next great step in the triumph of light is theosynthesis, from the Greek theos, God. By theosynthesis, light has created a fine-tuned apparatus, the mind, which is capable of having an image of God, the supreme light. The yogi, saint, or spiritual aspirant has started on her way to the light and let it work within her in order to unite with the universal center of light and achieve enlightenment. We are all children of light. Skolimowski's insights on theosynthesis bring us back to Easter and its surrounding events. including the Last Supper and what Jesus said about bread and wine. Jesus speaks in exalted mystical and symbolic language when he says, "This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." The gospel goes on to say, "In the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you.'" Luke 22:19-20. We allegorically consume completely enlightened nourishment. The body of Jesus, which has gone through all the stages of enlightenment, at least from the human perspective. Jesus Christ is our great example and teacher, our elder brother, as theosophists say. In his baptism in the Jordan, he was able to receive God's perfect image of humanity. After that point, working intently, he learned how to tune his physical body, ethics, thought, and action so finely that the divine light could completely transfigure matter and sacralize it. These themes require a great deal of thought. I could ask this: does Jesus' advice not to worry about what to eat and drink also include supersubstantial spiritual bread? Doesn't our Heavenly Father know that we need spiritual bread even before we ask for it? This is certainly the case. Supersubstantial bread is always available. There is no shortage of it. However, the problem lies in our readiness and ability to receive it, whether we are able to receive higher knowledge, light, and love. Our state of prayer and meditation, our ability to pray in spirit and truth, will determine whether we can receive supersubstantial bread. That state is directly related to ethical practices, which are needed to tune the receiver of our consciousness. If one asks what receiving supersubstantial bread requires from us, I would reply, tune your receiver. This point of view can be illuminated with this example. Many people wonder why they cannot live in the state of falling in love for a longer time, why the wonderful ecstasy disappears and we go back to our dull everyday life. I believe that falling in love has to do with a cosmic force, which is in the hands of destiny. This force attracts people who have karmic lessons to learn from each other. When the cloud of falling in love disappears and ordinary life begins, the wonderful memory of that experience keeps them together. Otherwise, they will have another lesson waiting for them in the future. But why does the cloud go away? It may be because the energies of love are so highly tuned that they cannot reside for a long time in a person whose mind is even occasionally filled with dark energies. These dark energies are created by hate, greed, grudges, vindictiveness, refusal to forgive, and aggression, to which people easily become emotionally attached. Love lives in freedom. A similar law operates with supersubstantial bread. Our being, the apparatus receiving the energy of light, or supersubstantial bread, has to be strong and pure spiritually. Our aim is spiritual freedom and independence. We have to become free from our attachments. An angry and hurtful mind, lying, sexual lust, addiction to aggression, hate, vindictiveness, and envy are the burdens that prevent us from ascending in spirit. They are like anchors that bind us to the mud. The saying, "Angels can fly because they can take themselves lightly," describes the matter very well. God will set those free who are ready to become free. The converse also applies. The person who is filled with anger, bitterness, and negative emotions cannot receive supersubstantial bread. When we pray as Jesus asked us to, in the Spirit and in truth, John 4:23, it tells us about our intention. We want to strive, we want to align our will with God's. Right alignment and right thought are important. it seems that we are back to Ervast's idea. A human being has been endowed with a spiritual tool, allowing him to rule the worlds. The spiritual tool is thought, and its proper use is meditation or prayer. Ervast says that at this point in the Lord's Prayer, we look for a right relationship with the world around us. The progress of each aspirant is being observed. When we eventually reach the right state of attunement, when we are just empty vessels, then that vessel can become filled with heavenly energy. When we have reached this point of contact, our understanding will gain new dimensions, and we have the opportunity to live with the energy of light. However, Jesus' advice is always worth remembering. But the things that come out of a person's mouth come from the heart, and these defile them. Matthew 15:18. We need spiritual bread, the light of spirit and cosmic energy, to carry on in the school of painful efforts. An old Finnish saying, bread keeps a man on the road, can be interpreted either from the material or the spiritual point of view. This is our experience in everyday life. We can think that the same is true in the case of spiritual nourishment. Spiritual bread keeps us on the path, if we recall Jesus' words, I am the truth and the life. John 14:6. Let us pray for supersubstantial bread in spirit and in truth, which keeps all of us, men and women alike, on the path to the truth and life. The most significant problem of our time. Throughout the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus teaches us new attitudes for our lives and way of being. He sees the bonds in our minds to which we are attached, and with his teachings and example, tries to show how we could be set free from those bonds. These bonds are attitudes, hardened ways of behaving, and models for thinking and acting that we have received from our culture. It is usually hard for us to ponder upon their significance in our lives, let alone to question them. The yoga of Jesus will unlock these attachments and blocks so that the spirit can be free and energies can freely flow in us. We call Jesus Savior, and rightly so, since this is what Jesus did. However, the church has monopolized this concept and wants to interpret it only in terms of the redemption, that is, Jesus died on the cross for our sins. According to the church, just by believing this, we are saved and will go to heaven. I will not address this doctrine of salvation any further here. I just want to pay attention to Jesus' role as a savior in terms of his spiritual teachings. Jesus provides us with an example of what we should do in our lives. One important teaching addresses the way we should react to unfairness and insults. Jesus teaches us to pray in the Lord's Prayer as follows. And forgive our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. Matthew 6:12. Here he shows us the direction of spiritual growth and liberation. We will be free if we follow this path. He says, the truth will set you free, and clarifies, I am the way and the truth and the life. We will see this path of freedom when we learn to forgive, to let go of negative emotions and their dominance. In this freed inner space within us, we can experience forgiveness for our own wrongdoings and evil deeds. This is the forgiveness promised by Jesus in his prayer for those who want to forgive. Our energies are unable to flow unless we learn how to let go of our negative emotions, but we want to hold on to them to keep them inside us and with us. Even if we don't want to do so, we do not know how to let go of them. Psychotherapist Tuulikki Saaristo talks about emotional hooks in her book Taika Sanat, The Magic Words, which discusses forgiveness. We are attached to these hooks, which is why we are under their spell. They are about insults, abuse, and criminal acts we might have encountered. These incidents arouse an emotional state that resurfaces again and again in our consciousness and constantly overwhelms us. In her book, Saarista provides a piece of evidence that helps us to get free from the emotional hook. It may appear to be mechanical, even too simple, but it has a certain logic, which I will try to describe later. Negative emotions can easily have a hold on us, but the same is also true of positive emotions. We often talk about attachments, emotions through which we become fond of other people. But when our spiritual path is towards truth, we will gradually learn to become free from our positive attachments as well. We will be free to love in a way that does not depend on its object. True love is the highest form of giving. It is unconditional giving, which is no longer transactional. In a transactional relationship, I will give only if I get love or something else in return. All of us will grow into unconditional love at some point in our evolution, but before we can start learning this, we must learn how to let go of negative emotional attachments such as vengefulness, bitterness, hatred, and hard feelings. These can be overcome by following Jesus' teaching and forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. The Occult Meaning of Forgiveness by Sergei O. Prokofiev, the late chairman of the Russian Anthroposophical Society, was translated into Finnish at the same time as Saarista Taikasana. Prokofiev considers forgiveness to be the most important ethical problem of our time. He provides some immensely powerful examples of the liberating effect of forgiveness in real life. In addition, he discusses the universal karmic effects that each of us can set in motion if we learn to forgive. Concentrating on this issue with the help of these two books can open for us the depth of the process of forgiveness and its therapeutic, even occult effect. I will unpack the mechanics of forgiveness and evaluate the meaning of the Lord's Prayer on forgiving. The next step into this matter requires introspection about one's own inner state regarding forgiveness. The true effects will present themselves to us. This is tested in the personal process. No one else will do it for us. A common sense analysis of the psychology of forgiveness quickly shows that it is not easy even to start thinking about this issue. When we believe that we should forgive, it feels like giving away or giving up something, swallowing pride, even losing face or self-worth. At the minimum, it feels like humbling oneself, perhaps showing some kind of weakness. Who would voluntarily do this? This factor is most prominent in situations where forgiveness is an alternative to revenge, for instance, for libel. When the pride of family, tribe, or a person, usually a male, has been violated, forgiveness seems impossible. It appears to be much manlier to pay back the violation, preferably with interest. This line of thinking has a long tradition in our culture. On the other hand, there is also a long tradition of forgiveness in the Christian nations. Indeed, forgiveness resides at the heart of Christian ethics. The ethics of Jesus as a whole is infinitely skillful in practice, even from the occult point of view. It is ancient Eastern wisdom by which Jesus, time after time, reverses the demands of receiving into giving. When those who approached Jesus were attached to something or wanted to keep something for themselves, he always advised them to let go, relinquish, give away, forgive. This logic of Jesus, this art of paradoxes, surprises us by turning things upside down and showing how apparent weaknesses and uncertainties can turn into assets. We want to cling to our tradition of hate and violence. We have been used to seeing our strength in coercion and force. Jesus teaches us to give up both and to see that in the long run, nonviolence is the best alternative. Jesus was a true radical in his life and teachings. It is unusual for someone to live by the principle of winning over hate through love. In a number of situations, Jesus taught how humility in a peculiar way turns into strength, weakening from within the aggressive opponent who trusts in coercion. Jesus also taught us about money and property, which for thousands of years have been targets for prey. He taught how giving up mammon is like taking off a straitjacket. Property is not only power. It is above all a relationship that mammon creates between us and other people. An individual who is free from this relationship cannot be forced into anything. Jesus taught how we should relate to power. True loving service will make us leaders. In the final analysis, the last will come first and vice versa. On the last day of his earthly life, Jesus showed how complete nonviolence, turning the other cheek, sacrifice and forgiveness, defy and conquer death with the power of love. The life of Jesus was a paradox. His radicalism was death-defying from the very start. It is not hard to see that he wanted to demonstrate that there is no death. Indeed, this is what he did. With his teachings and actions, Jesus established the New Covenant, whose cornerstone is non-resistance to evil. He placed grace and forgiveness in place of judgment. Jesus changed the Old Testament image of God. The vengeful Yahweh became a loving Father. At the same time, Jesus reversed old notions almost completely by luminously saying, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." Matthew 5:17. From the beginning, it has been difficult for the church to accept the paradoxical logic of Jesus. The patriarchal and authoritarian societies of the Middle East and the Roman Empire could not take this new prophet who preached the brotherhood of humanity and the equality of the suppressed, women, and all who are less fortunate. Once enough time had passed after Jesus' death, the church gradually de-emphasized his radical teachings in order to make space for dogmatism, which was better suited to the interests of the state and those in power. An image of God was established closer to that of the Old Testament patriarch, who ruled more with fear of hell than with mercy and love. The church quickly came to realize that Jesus' teachings are too demanding for it and its members. According to the church, clemency was not the right way to keep the crowds at bay and in obedience to the Lord. Consequently, one of the key pillars of mercy, the doctrine of reincarnation, was declared heretical at the Second Council of Constantinople in 553. The church has preferred to build on the doctrine of redemption and the forgiveness of sins as the cornerstone of Christianity. This doctrine presents the choice between heaven and eternal damnation as a key ethical incentive. The church made an alliance with the state and has constantly been forced to give up its principles when the state's power ambitions have demanded it. Consequently, the church regards Jesus as more a redeemer than a teacher. For a long time, it has been in an awkward situation, being compelled to belittle individual ethical thinking and aspirations. In regard to forgiveness, it has emphasized how sinners are absolved rather than forgiving others or what could unfold from that. The church has not understood that when we are able to forgive others, we will also forgive ourselves and will be freed from our own lack of forgiveness. It seems that we have had a poor understanding of what Jesus promises us in the Lord's Prayer. He says that if we are able to forgive others their debts to us, our Heavenly Father will forgive us. the initiative is ours. We must understand and learn to be free from this burden of hatred, bitterness, false pride, vengefulness, the desire to deliver justice, and the vicious cycle of retribution. One or more of these feelings are always behind an inability to forgive, which will become a real burden and haunt us. Jesus promises that if we can forgive, we will be free from this burden, and at the same time, we will be forgiven our own old debts. The Eastern wisdom calls these old debts karma, which comes to us from our past lives. It is worth noting that the original Greek of the Lord's Prayer talks about debts, opelemata, rather than trespasses, which is the word used by the Church. For us, it is important to calmly think about the nature of these debts, which manifest themselves in different ways that we may not recognize as debts. The debt always resides in between the relationship between us and the other person. And as we have seen, the debt always burdens the one who incessantly demands compensation, retribution, and revenge. That is, I must be the one who is given amends. This attitude is not easy to spot. The burden of insult or even of crime is usually carried by the one who has been wronged. The wrongdoer may not even remember what happened and could even be dead. The debt burdens the victim, not the wrongdoer, and it feels like guilt. This creates a peculiar, yet common, psychological setup. It is as if the victim were somehow guilty for what happened. One could even conclude that with a crime, the guilt is absorbed by the person who is able to do so, who is often the victim. The wrongdoer often doesn't see any need for remorse. It is difficult to be free of emotional hooks such as bitterness, lust for revenge, and grievances. We cannot forgive. This is how the wronged person suffers and relives the same offense even for years. It happens every time the memory of the unpleasant situation surfaces in the victim's consciousness. Pekka Arvast unfolds this complex issue from a karmic point of view in his book, The Divine Seed. He reminds us that we all have a debt to life. This includes the fact that in the heavenly state, when we were at the gate of rebirth, we were allowed to have a vision of our next incarnation. In that heavenly state, we accepted our destiny and promised to try our best to make the next life similar to the vision. Yet in the course of our lives, we stumble and fall and cannot fulfill the heavenly promise. We wrong others and ourselves in many situations. This debt has been accumulating over many incarnations. In bright moments of our lives, we may be allowed to feel true happiness, that is, heavenly love. In these exalted moments, we get close to the heavenly state and see the enormous beauty of life, as well as the limitless love and grace that surround us all the time, although we usually don't see them. In such special moments, we have the inner strength to renew our vow. I want to try again. I want to be good, and I want to do my best. We should be able to forgive ourselves, and when we are filled with happiness, we can do so. These moments teach us graciousness and show that we can have mercy on each other. Let us recall Jesus' words, "Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy." Jesus didn't urge us to pray that if we pay our debts, we will also be paid. This appears to be self-evident. The debt can be about money, but it can be about other things as well. Everything we give to other people, such as money, goods, property, and services, can create a liability for debt in our own mind. When I give love to someone, say my son or daughter, it can prompt a thought that I should receive love in return. The statement, "I have loved you so much," is no doubt familiar to many. Often we are unable even to give a present without expecting something back. We might even think, "Am I being stupid when I give a present to that person?" She might not even be grateful, or perhaps she will just take advantage of my kindness. These thoughts poison our minds and prevent us from experiencing the true joy of giving. When we give with a right mind, we don't necessarily believe that everything we give away will come back to us manifold. This kind of giving is always an act of love, and each act of love will remain as a permanent entry in the book of life. The more that people are strangers to us, the more precious our gift is. These entries in the book of life are the treasures in heaven that Jesus advises us to gather. A great Finnish poet, Eino Leino, said it very beautifully in his Smiling Apollo. Around the earth there are many creeds. One lacking and all are deficient, one creed alone, but the singer he needs, its bounds are for him sufficient. For me its gentle religion will do. Eternal promise, it clearly rings true, and enough I think of its trace will remain when sunset returns again. Giving is the law of life, a central part of love and loving. Thus it is connected to the magnificent goal of learning in the school of life. To love one another. This is our task. We learn it by giving with no expectation of getting something in return, by serving without hoping to be served, by forgiving one another without expecting compensation or immediate justice. If forgiving is real, amends will be made and justice will be done at the same time. By forgiving, we atone and do justice. We see how important mercy is, both for the person who receives it and for the one who is able to show mercy instead of justice. The great life, which has given us so much, is waiting for us to understand the law of life. Everything must flow, nobody and nothing, except our own foolishness, is forcing us to attach our minds for years to an insignificant debt, insult, or thought of revenge. Merely reminiscing about these things makes us relive the situation over and over, thinking of the ways we will teach a lesson to the wrongdoer. We can remember the pattern of being offended from childhood, which can continue into adolescence. We withdraw into our shells and sulk for a long time. In the worst cases, we harm ourselves thinking, they will be so sorry when they see how badly I ended up and understand that it was all their fault. The debts addressed in Jesus' prayer are accumulated when someone wrongs us and we demand amends and justice or harbor a desire for revenge. Usually, we don't realize that everyone who harms another person harms himself. If we feel insulted, we want to pay back in kind. We want to teach a lesson to the debtor. Our mind is stuck, believing in the teaching method originated from the old code of Hammurabi. An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. This makes us blind and toothless, yet we call ourselves Christians, followers of Christ. How long does it take to discover a better teaching method than insulting the insulter or hitting the hitter? We adults teach by hitting back. We often think that the lesson is learned even better if we hit back hard. We imagine that the aggressor doesn't know what it feels like to be hit. It has been said about a Finnish man that if he doesn't understand, he hits. It is very often true. In many cases, these acts of violence are cries for help. Is it about time for us who do understand to learn a new way and make it visible? Turning the other cheek is a huge step forward in spiritual growth. It has nothing to do with fear. It is more like a Zen act, which teaches by doing the opposite of what the opponent expects. I have already discussed slander and the debt of honor. This is probably a passing custom in the history of mankind, which has to do with the codes and habits of tribal societies. Avenging slander is associated with hierarchical communities, in which the hierarchy is, with no exception, patriarchal and usually maintained with some sort of violence. Mafia organizations provide an illuminating example of this conduct. When one closely examines these cases of defamation, one notices that the issue is not about honor, but about supporting the power of a leader with weak self-esteem and of a hierarchy maintained with terror and violence. Real honor comes differently. It is not born from violence or coercion, and it is not restored by revenge. Honor is spiritual authority, which grows from righteousness, not from physical strength. It can be hard to forgive even when we want to. A central reason is that we think forgiving is accepting injustice, the wrong deed that was done to us. However, this is not the case. By forgiving, we show that we want to understand the deed of the person who has wronged us. We might even be able to see things from his perspective. This takes compassion. Another obstacle in forgiving is our inner demand for justice, which has to do with the attitude described above. We may be unable to forgive, even if we don't believe that forgiving implies accepting a wrong. The reason often lies in our conviction that the wrongdoer should be punished for what he did. We want to teach injustice. We demand that at least the debtor apologize to us. We don't want to set him free unless he is paid in kind, as conceived by us. We believe that justice is not served if we forgive. That is why we often suffer on our own emotional hooks. We refuse to let the debtor go without a punishment. But we don't see that in reality our debtor doesn't suffer, we do. We punish ourselves with this pain, even though it troubles the accuser, not the accused. The demand for justice is based on the belief that everyone will not get what he is due. Because we are not familiar with the law of karma, we don't believe that it will take care of the situation with the immutable vigor of a natural law. Hence, we want to take justice into our own hands. It is always easier to serve justice than to show mercy. H.P. Blavatsky, co-founder of the Theosophical Society, wrote in her Key to Theosophy, quote, "The chief point is to uproot that most fertile source of all crime and immorality, the belief that it is possible for them to escape the consequences of their own actions." Jesus urges us to forgive in order to make us think what it means in practice and to make us follow this advice in our lives. I personally recall a small incident about a money debt that weighed me down for a long time. At the end of the 70s, a man came to my office as if he were an old acquaintance and asked me to lend him 250 Finnish marks. At first, I thought I could not give that kind of money to a stranger. I had seen him a couple of times, and he hadn't made a good impression on me. Then he suggested that we could write a promissory note. I wanted to help, and I thought that because of this note, he would pay the money back. I lent him the money. Afterwards, my colleague said, "We hope that you didn't give him any money. He never pays it back." I answered that it was okay because we signed a promissory note. My colleagues responded with sarcastic laughter, "Oh, that makes a difference. You have absolutely nothing to worry about then." On the agreed date and time, I was waiting for this man to pay his debt. Nothing happened. I met him much later in a restaurant and asked whether he remembered that I lent him 250 marks. "Yeah." "Well, could you pay me back?" "I have no money now." "When will you have money?" "I have no idea." I realized that he had no intention of paying me back. It bothered me for a long time. Who would file a court case over 250 marks? This incident happened a decade ago, but I still noticed that every time I thought about it, my adrenaline levels soared and I got angry. How can a person be so treacherous, so disgusting? He should at least be beaten up to make him learn a lesson. While preparing an article, I stumbled upon Jesus' verse, "And forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors." I started to think that this was something that must be done, but how? Before long, an acquaintance gave me a small booklet from Alcoholics Anonymous called Father in Heaven. I read it with interest. This booklet advises how to make a decision to forgive. One needs to go in solitude and quiet down. Then one says a familiar prayer, followed by these quiet words, translated from the Finnish version of the booklet. Quote, I will freely forgive X, the name of the person. I release him and let him go. I will completely forgive him this matter at hand. As far as I'm concerned, this is over. I will give all the bitterness to Christ. X is now free and I am free. I wish him success in life. This case is closed. The Christ truth has set us both free. I thank God. After this is done, you can resume your activities. Do not repeat the instructions. If the matter comes back to your mind, let it go. You will notice that it will come back less often until it is forgotten or becomes insignificant. I followed the instructions in the booklet. It worked. I stumbled upon my debtor. He almost slipped away in the street, although he clearly recognized me. Nevertheless, I turned around and went over to greet him in a friendly manner, asking how he was doing and so on. I smiled internally while doing this, since I had conquered my bitterness. I felt light. I had also forgiven myself for my lack of forgiveness, which had continued for a long time. I gradually started to understand the theory behind what happened to me. In her book Magic Words, Saaristo describes a method that is quite similar to the AA method of forgiveness. Saaristo talks about the emotional hook, which is our attitude toward the deed requiring compensation. Experts tell us that we are responsible for our own emotions. Only we can decide whether we want to desire revenge, feel anger, or demand justice. No one else is responsible for our attitude. The wrongdoer is responsible for his actions, and the law of karma will take care of the consequences. But it is the person who was wronged that has the emotional reaction. No one else is responsible for that, and no one else can liberate her from it. Saaristo provides a simple exercise for forgiveness, which is implemented in the evening before going to sleep. When the book was published, it attracted quite a lot of attention and interest. Saaristo held workshops based on her book. She observed that the release of emotional hooks as a result of the forgiveness exercise often manifests itself as more lively dreams. I remember a study group in which I participated. In one meeting, a woman told us about a dream in which she was invited to visit her friend in Madrid. When she arrived, a reception was arranged in a yard, which was decorated with beautiful flowers and bushes. A group of friends came to meet her, and she was told that they had prepared a gift for her. The gift was a beautiful white house in the inner garden. The woman noticed in her dream that withered weeds were growing through an iron fence from the next door yard. She started to root out the neighbor's weeds. However, a voice in her dream told her not to do so. Instead, she was advised just to take care of the tidiness of her own yard. About a year before she passed away, an Estonian healer and clairvoyant, Lou Levilma, visited Helsinki in the Forum Humanum lecture series. I talked with her before the lecture and asked what role forgiveness plays in healing. She responded that it is essential in almost all healings. She provided an example in the lecture about an old man who was brought to her by his children. The man was completely exhausted. Vilma examined him and soon realized what was the matter. She asked the man, "Tell me, who do you hate?" Surprised, the man admitted that he had indeed hated his neighbor for 30 years. In addition, the man revealed that he could converse with the neighbor without letting him know that he hated him. Vilma advised the man to stop hating his neighbor and told him that he must forgive him. If he didn't do this, he would die soon. The man was relieved by the discussion. He assured his children that they could go and he was perfectly capable of finding his way home. When walking back home, he forgave his own hatred with one step and forgave his neighbor with every other. Some time later, Vilma received a concerned phone call from a neighboring house, which was located a bit less than a mile away from hers. The caller told about an elderly, tired man who told that he was coming from Vilma's reception and asked permission to use the toilet. The caller asked what on earth had happened because the toilet was clogged with feces consisting of little stones. Vilma reassured her that they were just kidney stones, which had come out in a natural way. The hatred had precipitated into kidney stones over the years, and they left the man's body. In this real-life story, feuding and refusing to forgive had their effects all the way down to physical reality. When hate and revengefulness are nourished long enough, there are only two alternatives: either the hate leaves or the spirit leaves, that is, the person dies. In The Occult Meaning of Forgiveness, Prokofiev tells about two shocking cases that took place during World War II. They indicate how the person who forgives receives great resources and how cosmic forces are liberated when we are able to forgive and start living a new life. The guardians of the law of karma will ensure with ironclad precision that every crime, insult, and so on will have their consequences in this or some other incarnation. However, if we know how to forgive, the forces of these hierarchical beings will be liberated, and, quote, there gradually begins to arise, in the very heart of that realm of iron karmic necessity which permeates our entire cosmos, a new kingdom where karma becomes grace and where Christ himself works as the law of karma, unquote. We usually do not think about these influences, but every concrete debt, desire to have amends, lust for revenge, or bitterness called by another that you can forgive is part of your own liberation. You will be freed from the prison of debt to which you have been tied. Jesus' advice about settling quickly with our adversary while we are still together on the way, that is, while we are still living in this reality, is well suited to forgiving our adversaries. Matthew 5:25. We cannot deal with these matters in the afterlife. If you act wisely, you might acquire an admirer or even a friend who begins to see how a miracle of love takes form in the process of forgiving. Indeed, redemption on a small scale will take place. With your forgiveness, you have brought a piece of Christ's heaven here to earth. This is what our Master did when he said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. Jesus knew and understood the meaning of his deed, and we are gradually beginning to understand this great example ourselves.